Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market. Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Chase Thomas podcast. The Chase Thomas podcast. My nephew needs me to record. See, I already hate it.
All right, hello, and welcome back to a Tuesday afternoon edition of the Chase Thomas podcast. I am still the aforementioned Chase Thomas, and I'm joined by NBA international sensation. I believe that is the right adjective to describe Carlin Gay. Carlin, good afternoon, sir. How are you?
CT, what's going on, my friend? I'm well, can't complain, and excited for potentially seeing someone new hoist the championship in the NBA.
Well, someone new regardless, right? Like, that's one of the cool things about this finals situation is that it's going to be somebody that we have not seen in a long time, two franchises that have been dying for this kind of success and to bring it home. I think, I don't know, like, it's interesting. Like, do you think this is it? Do you think the Bucks, like, let's just start here. Do you think this feels like the beginning of the end? Like, I read Lowe's piece on ESPN today, and I was like, well, if I had any optimism left, I think that's just gone. And just seeing, like, Chris Paul has to play a perfect game for the Suns to win the series. Okay, perfect, great. Like, what? I don't know. Are you that dubious about Phoenix's chances, or what do you think right now going into tonight?
I'm about 70% there. I'm really about 70% there, and here's why. I think the Bucks over the last 3 years have learned to win. So that goes against Phoenix because they haven't had to be in these positions before or at all, in their franchise history, really. The last time that happened, you know, some of these guys weren't even born yet that are playing on the team. So that's a part of it. The second part of it is, I do believe some of it is Chris Paul's injury. I don't think he's 110% healthy. And if they are going to come back in, you know, dramatic fashion against the Milwaukee Bucks playing at this level, they're going to need Chris Paul running on, you know, his best. The next two games better be the best of his career if they're going to get back into it. So that's a part of it. And then I just kind of look at the body language from both sides. You know, you look at the press conferences, and I know, you know, a lot of us spend time digging into the numbers, and I'm sure we're going to do that in a little bit here, but you just look at the body language from both sides, and I look at Giannis on one side. He's talking about taking tinkles. And then I look at the other side, you know, where you have Devin Booker, who was answering, you know, this reporter, you know, his name escapes me, but he got crushed for asking Devin Booker how he felt for Chris Paul or how poorly he felt for Chris Paul after losing in game five and being one game away from eliminated. And I think we piled on him, you know, when I say we, I'm talking about the collective social media gang that everyone is. They kind of piled on this reporter, poor guy, you know, got, you know, beat up virtually for asking that question. But to me, it wasn't a bad question. It was just a poorly worded question. And if, you know, when the worlds were reversed a little bit, Chase, when, you know, after the first two games, that same question was asked in reverse. When they were up 2-0, the Phoenix Suns, I'm talking about, of course, you know, they were asking questions like, hey, how happy are you for Chris Paul? Devin Booker was more than happy to answer that question. Well, now it's flipped around. And he's one game away from failing. And I'm talking about Chris Paul here. And Devin Booker is getting asked that question, like, how bad do you feel if Chris Paul's not able to get to the finish line? And he's asked, you know, his answer is next question. And I have no problem with that. I have no problem with that answer. My problem is that if he didn't want that question asked, he should have nipped that in the bud at the beginning and said, you know what, this is a team sport. You know, granted, Chris Paul is our leader, it's a team sport, but we're happy as a collective. If he didn't answer the way he did at the beginning, he wouldn't have had to answer the way, or he wouldn't have had to answer that type of question closer in the end. And the way he answered that, the way they looked at each other, the way that the Phoenix Suns have been answering those questions the last three games after, you know, really getting bludgeoned by the Milwaukee Bucks, and I'm sure we'll talk about that, you know, in depth in a little bit. I'm seeing a body language where it doesn't feel like they believe that they can come back, and that hurts me more than anything else.
Yeah, it's just strange because Monty just being the elite level coach, and we thought that the Suns had the coaching advantage coming into this game too, and you see what Bud's done, and like, just when Lopez is out, they switch everything, and a lot of their defensive adjustments came after game one and what they saw in game one. I don't know. I like what you're saying about the body language though, because like, I wonder with Devin Booker never being here, and just the Bucks, I feel like have more of a sense of urgency with this group, and they don't even necessarily need to have it because, I mean, Drew's locked up, Middleton's locked up, Giannis is locked up. It's not like this core is really going anywhere, but it is kind of interesting to see the level of urgency and them just piling on, like you said. And this is something I think about too when I'm watching games and I'm taking notes, and I wonder if you're the same way, but like, we knew going into this series that the Bucks just being the best transition offense in basketball, that would not happen as much in this series, and the Suns would take some of that away. But then, like, do you notice that they're not getting as much and they're still surviving in the half court? Does anything look better about what the Bucks are doing offensively? And do you notice things like Phoenix getting the corner threes getting taken away, like as this three game losing streak for them has taken place? Do you notice in real time that, like, oh man, these are not open, or Devin Booker is not able to find the open guy here when he's got Pat Connaughton switched on him? Are you noticing that in real time?
What I'm noticing is a couple things. One is that, you know, the Phoenix Suns are playing really good basketball, and they're still losing. You know, when you talk about the shooting that they've been able to bring to the table, they're shooting 50% from the floor as a team and 40% from three as a team. They're getting to the line and they're knocking those free throws down. They're shooting 86% from the free throw line as a team. So I don't think they could shoot any better from the floor. You look at Devin Booker, he's averaging 30 points in the series, you know, back-to-back 40-point games, and both of those were losses. We had the big game. You always want in a final series an X-factor to kind of step up and have a big game. We got that from Mikal Bridges in game two. We haven't had much, you know, response from anyone else in the games beyond that. So, you know, DeAndre Ayton's numbers are going to look fine by the end of the series. He's averaging a double-double, and he's over a steal and a block and a half for the series. So you're not really seeing a giant hole in the Phoenix Suns except for one area, and that one area is the rebounding. And I think that's where the Milwaukee Bucks really started to take hold of this series, is when they realized that, hey, we are bigger than the Phoenix Suns, and we're actually going to use that to our advantage. You know, game three is really when it turned. You know, the Suns were out-rebounded 47-36 overall. They allowed Milwaukee to grab 13 offensive boards in that game. Game four, +8 on the glass in favor of Milwaukee. They grabbed 17 offensive rebounds in that game. And then in game five, it was a lot closer on the boards. They were only able to out-rebound them by two, but there was 11 extra chances, 11 offensive rebounds that the Milwaukee Bucks were able to pull down in that game. And I don't care how poorly you shoot from the field or how poorly you shoot from the foul line if you're in the case of Milwaukee, any NBA team that gets multiple chances at putting the ball in the basket, they're going to end up doing so. And what it also does, Chase, is it extends your defensive possession. It makes you have to play a little longer. Everyone is tired in this series. Everyone's tired in this series. They're all playing major minutes. They're all going through this war of attrition that we call the NBA, you know, season, and ultimately the NBA finals. And the last thing you want is to play defense for 20 seconds of the shot clock, do it really well, get the shot that you want, have them miss, which is the result you want, and you don't clean it up with the board. And that's what's happening to the Phoenix Suns, and it becomes deflating. because you're now giving them back-to-back possessions. You're now putting them in a situation, them being Milwaukee, where they can kind of build some momentum and kill yours. It doesn't matter how many jump shots you're hitting on one end. If you spend the majority of time on your third of the floor, you're going to be in trouble. And that's adding to the fatigue. And you're seeing it really late in the fourth quarter where Phoenix, you know, throughout the regular season, they were a really good clutch team. You know, Chris Paul was one of the best clutch performers in the entire league this year. But over the course of the 48 minutes that we've seen in the playoffs, we saw it a lot in that game five where everything was on the line. Basically, the series was on the line. It looked to me like the Phoenix Suns were really depending on Devin Booker because he was the only guy that had gas in his tank. Everybody else didn't have the legs. Everybody else didn't just have the wherewithal to be able to rise to the occasion. On the other end, the Bucks got it from everywhere. PJ Tucker looked like he was healthy and ready to lay some lumber. You saw Giannis. He was walking up the floor in the second quarter because he was gassed, but he sprinted up the floor in that last possession when Jrue Holiday comes up with a steal and throws down the alley-oop. Like, he found gas when he needed it. Holiday's been there, and then, of course, Milton with his time of shooting. The Bucks are really imposing their will and using their size. And to use a boxing analogy, they're throwing body blows, and really those body blows are starting to accumulate on the Phoenix Suns. And it's only going to be a matter of time where this knockout punch is on its way.
So you're looking for the knockout punch. Like, you're expecting that at this point.
I am. And I said 70% there because I think how game six plays out is this. We haven't really seen the great shooting performance from the Milwaukee Bucks here in this finals. I think they go back home. I think they start, really knocking down threes where, we haven't seen one of those games where Brook Lopez goes crazy from 3-point range in this, in this playoffs, really. He's only shooting, 27% or 28% rather from 3-point range in the finals. So he hasn't had one of those games where, Lopez is launching and knocking down three threes to start the game. We're going to get the Bobby Portis minutes where he energizes the crowd and hypes everybody up. And then Giannis is going to do him. And I'm really worried for there's going to be an offensive wave chase that I think that the Bucks are going to put on the Suns. I'm really worried that the Suns believe enough in themselves to overcome that and make a comeback on the road. They played their best road game, I believe, in game four and still lost. And that is going to be in their back of their minds if that situation happens again. It's like, we gave it our best in game four and we still lost on the road. We gave it our best. We played pretty well in game five and lost at home. It's hard to have those short memories. And I really do think that if the Bucks jump on them early, we're going to start celebrating the Milwaukee Bucks throughout the end of the second quarter or second half. It's sort of like with the Lakers last year, right? It was in the bubble. It went down to a game six. Miami had a little bit of momentum, but they just didn't have enough. And when the Lakers turned it on in game six and really started to pour it on, there was no response. There was nothing left for Miami to give. And you saw that the game kind of ran away from them. I do expect that to happen in game six here in Milwaukee.
It's crazy we're here. Like, just think about like how Milwaukee, like I was looking back at like pieces of like, oh, Milwaukee's in trouble after game one. And then after game two, it's like, uh-oh, this could be Suns in five. And I had coming to the series, like I just didn't really see how the Suns did not win as the more complete team. And I just expected Suns in six. And we're now here where it looks like the Bucks in six is very, very possible. Like, if anyone thought the Bucks were winning, I just saw a lot of Bucks in seven if it just goes a long time. And a lot of it just depended on Giannis's health. And Giannis is clearly fine. And then you think about like how they got here. Like, Phoenix's road was pretty clean, and we can talk, like, I shouldn't say we could talk, because it feels silly to talk about what Phoenix did to get here in terms of the injuries they were faced with at an opposing teams. Like, that's not their fault. Like, they play the hand they're dealt, and they move through. They did what they were supposed to do. But with the Bucks, like, the Bucks actually didn't look good. Like, the difference between the Bucks and the Suns route is the Suns looked good as they were moving through the Western Conference, even if injuries derailed a lot of these teams. Like, they still look good doing it. And then you look at the East, where the Hawks would have won that series if Trey doesn't get hurt. I still believe that to my core. Like, I think the Hawks would have won that series. And I think Trey was just, it was a bummer. It was a gigantic bummer to see that series go the way it did. And then you look before that, I mean, the Nets, if the Nets are healthy, we can just go ahead and pencil them in. Like, it took everything. It took just having one net of the big three available for the Bucks to squeak by that series. It's like, this team has not been impressive to this point, and now they pull out their most impressive feat in the finals. I think that's wild to me that nobody saw it coming. This is why you play the games, right? Is that the Bucks came out and looked their best in the NBA Finals when they just did not look like a championship team just throughout the summer. Like, they just haven't looked like it, and they really shouldn't even be here. Is that a fair characterization? And it's not an attack of Bucks fans that they shouldn't enjoy. It's just that, like, it's wild that they're playing their best basketball right now based on what we saw before this.
Yeah. You know what I think it is, Chase? I think we got kind of spoiled with the dominance that were the Golden State Warriors and how they were able to kind of mow down the competition on their way to championships. Because I think when you look beyond them, if you remove them and you look at the champions that we've seen in the NBA, and let's just look at the last two, right? The Lakers and the Raptors. They didn't look their best, you know, each and every single outing in the playoffs. You know, when you look at the Toronto Raptors, they were down against the Philadelphia 76ers and had to win a big time game four on the road to get back in control of that series. You know, and they were four bounce shot away from even getting to the conference finals. And when they get to the conference finals, they're down 0-2 against these very same Milwaukee Bucks that we're talking about here, and had to overcome that and get to, you know, the finals, and they win the big game one, but then they lose home court advantage, you know, in game two against a Warriors team that had been there before and knew what they had to do to win and everything else. So they also had the same luck that the Milwaukee Bucks had in terms of the injuries that, you know, they saw along the way. When they got to the finals, you know, we know what happened with Kevin Durant. We know what happened with Klay Thompson in game six. We still haven't seen Klay Thompson back, unfortunately, on a basketball court since then. So, and then when you look at, you know, in that Philly series, you know, Joel Embiid has the stomach issues. Who knows if he's completely healthy, what happens there? The Magic weren't going to give them any trouble, but they lose game one to the Orlando Magic, and then it's, oh, here we go again. Are the Raptors going to, you know, stub their toe on their way to a playoff in their playoff run when they should be really competing for a championship? So there were questions that were brought up for the Toronto Raptors that they had to answer every single way along the way. And then finally, they get to game six of the finals on the road in a tough place to play, and we see their best basketball game as a complete team. Fred VanVleet goes insane, knocks down three-pointers upon three-pointers. Siakam has a great game, and it starts off with Kyle Lowry setting the tone early in that game, having the best game of his life, in my opinion, in that game six. And then Kawhi Leonard did Kawhi Leonard things, and now we're looking at an NBA championship team. I think last year with the Lakers, it was the same thing. How many people picked the upset between the Lakers and Blazers right out of the gate? The Blazers were hot coming into the bubble. Everyone said that Lakers couldn't guard Dame. They couldn't guard CJ. They lose game one to the Lakers, and all of a sudden, well, they made quick work of the Portland Trail Blazers, and that was an issue. Can they guard Jokic when they get to the conference finals, right? Like, that was the question. Can they guard Westbrook when he's playing, you know, the five? How are they going to do that? They walk through both those teams and get to the finals. And then the Heat, you know, they had a great run and looked amazing, but the Lakers had to answer questions all along the way. And of course, when you have LeBron James on your team, the doubts aren't as big as when you have Giannis on your team, but there were still doubts. You know, there's still, is LeBron old? You know, is he too old? Is Anthony Davis going to live up to the hype? Is he going to be healthy? Can KCP knock down threes? I think every championship team, even beyond the last two I talked about, are going to have questions on their way to the title. So we got spoiled for that run for the Golden State Warriors because they were just so dominant with KD there and Steph. They barely lost on the way there, so we really never got to ask those type of questions. It was just like a foregone conclusion. They're going to get to the finals, and they're going to see LeBron, and they're going to knock them out in five. Like, there's no question about it. But the realistic situation here is when you look back at the history of the NBA champions that we've ever seen, you go back to the 80s and 90s and even beyond that, there were always questions for the teams that got to and went on these deep playoff runs. And the Milwaukee Bucks are just falling into that pattern. The difference is with them is that a lot of their questions actually began 2 years ago in 2018 when the Raptors knocked them out, or two seasons ago, I should say. And they were still there and left to be answered when, you know, the Heat basically swept them. They generally swept them last year. So I think a lot of those questions are being answered in real time. And it's taking us time to kind of give them the credit that they deserve because, you know, Jrue Holiday's been fantastic in these playoffs. You know, defensively, his offense has been hit and miss, but when he does play really well offensively, we see the result. Chris Middleton is a bona fide number two. I think any team in the NBA would love to have a Chris Middleton on their team. And then what I've seen out of Giannis, Chase, we've seen growth from him from this first series to where he is now. My one criticism from Giannis is not his shooting. I don't care if he can shoot threes or not. I think he'll be able to score regardless. I don't care if he's a great free throw shooter. I've accepted the fact that that's not going to be the case. My only issue for him coming into this playoffs where it was, you know, and my only criticism was I think he played too fast. I think he always tried to play at a speed that, you know, didn't allow him to see the game, rather, you know, or even feel the game. He was just kind of like, I'm bigger, stronger than you. I'm just going to bulldoze my way to the rim no matter what. And what we're seeing now is we're seeing him kind of take that step back, and he's thinking the game more than he ever has. And that's a scary proposition for the rest of the NBA, not just the Phoenix Suns in game 6 and 7, if there is one, but the rest of the NBA, because it happened with the greats, all the greats that we've seen. Jordan figured it out. He was dominant. He was a great scorer. But when he started winning championships is when he started thinking the game, when he started trusting his teammates to take the big shots. And that's why we get the Paxton three that, you know, leads them on the run that they end up going on. That's why we get the Kerr highlights that lead them on the run that, you know, they end up going on. We see it with LeBron James. It wasn't until he really started to trust D-Wade and Chris Bosh and the Mike Millers that he wins a championship and that he takes that mentality back to Cleveland and the rest is history there. Kevin Durant, same thing. You know, it wasn't until he had teammates around him that he could trust that he was able to get to the mountaintop. And Kobe Bryant, same thing. So I think in Kobe's second run, I mean, not the first run. The first one was kind of, he was kind of the sidekick. But when he was the leader of the team, it wasn't until he trusted Powell and Ron Artest and the Vucevic's, Sasha Vucevic's, and all those guys to get them over the hump. Giannis is in that same position. He knows he's a great player. But to win and achieve at a high level, he has to have everyone else elevate to his level. And we're seeing that big time, Chase. When's the last time you saw Giannis take a charge? Like, when was the last time you saw him take a charge? And this is real, because when you look at Giannis, and I think I went back and I looked at this for one of the pieces I wrote for NBA.com. Giannis had 2 years ago had 68 charges in a regular season, an entire regular season. You followed that up with 65. This year he was in the 50s. He was in the low 50s. And while they obviously played a lot less games, it's a difference between him getting himself into foul trouble where he's being taken out of playoff games very early with two quick fouls and has to sit and watch the rest of the game. And then after the game, we ask, oh, how come Bud's only playing him 35 minutes? Well, part of that is A, he gets fired, and then B, he's in foul trouble. We haven't seen that in these finals. He's been able to play in these games. He has 3 charges in the 5 games that he's in these finals. 2 of them came in the first 2 games. He had 1 game 1, 1 game 2. The third was in game 3 on a moving screen. That's it. He hasn't been in those situations where he stands at the top of the key, he looks at the defense is able to build a wall, and he says, you know what, I'm going to be Bo Jackson. I'm going to put my head down and try to get through you and then force the ref to make a decision and put me in a foul trouble. We haven't seen that from him. We've seen him look at the defense and say, oh, you guys are sitting the wall up? Okay, cool. Here's Pat Connaughton for a corner 3. Here's Drew Holiday. How about I let Chris Middleton be a playmaker? Let me rely on these guys and let them do things and get the ball back to me. So it's slowing down. It's also the trust of his teammates for me that has put them in this situation. I really love seeing the growth from this Bucks team. They're answering the questions. And then more importantly, I think Giannis is really decided, you know, he's starting to trust his teammates. And that is scary for the rest of the Eastern Conference, because this is a team now that is a core of Giannis, Middleton, and Holiday that's going to be together for quite some time.
You're at a sports bar and you're watching game 6 tonight, and someone looks over and they're like, oh, it's Carlin Gay from NBA International. And they're like, hey, what's going on with Chris Paul? I keep saying that he's hurt, but he's denying that he's hurt. What would you point to be like, okay, this is an example of why this dude's not 100% in this series?
Well, one thing is he's hurt. You know, I do think that is the case. But when you remove that, I think the major question or the major answer that you know that everyone should say is Drew Holiday. You know, Drew Holiday has done an incredible job of beating Chris Paul up. It has been tough for Chris Paul to even just get past half court. The amount of pressure that he's being put on, you know, the minute he catches the ball on the inbound is tremendous. So you're asking a guy to, you know, not only play, you know, 35 minutes around that, maybe even 40 in these last couple of games to just get to the point where you're in the game, but then you have him, you know, you're playing heavy minutes at age 35. I think that's going to catch up to you, even if he wasn't injured. it's a mental toughness that Chris Paul has to have. He has to match that with, you know, the physical, you know, attributes that he's been given. He's not a big guy. He's having to box out, you know, every single possession, because on the other, on the defensive end, he's guarding one of the, you know, two best players on the floor at any given time, whether it's Chris Middleton or Jrue Holiday. But also, he's going to have to box them out because they've been getting crushed on the glass. He is taking a physical beating. And I don't know that his body at the age that he's at is able to hold up. It's been tough for him. You're seeing him take some frustrating, you know, fouls throughout. He has to play at such a level on every possession offensively, and he has to be thinking the game at such a high level on every possession offensively that I do think that that contributes to, you know, some of his fatigue that's been building up on him. Because yes, Devin Booker is a great playmaker, but they just go to another level when they have both Devin Booker and Chris Paul going at the same time. You know, Paul had a decent game in game five, but you didn't feel it. You know, the last time we really felt Chris Paul's impact was game one. You know, he had a great game, 32-9. He shot 63% from the field. It was an incredible game. Since then, you know, he's had, when you look back at his counting numbers, it's been fine, but you don't feel the impact. You know, you don't feel the big basket. You don't feel the momentum shifting play. He's not taking a charge. You know, he's not coming up with one of those pickpockets. He's not doing the old Chris Paul where I stop in front of you and you fall over my back. And you know, those fouls pile up. We haven't seen some of that stuff from Chris Paul that we've come to know and love, where it's frustrating for you to play against him. He's just kind of having to, you know, be a bully and bulldoze his way down the floor. And then when he gets there, you're already, you know, 14 seconds on the clock. And then I got to find either Booker or I got to find Bridges. I know I got to get Ayton to touch, and then I have to score my own. It is a lot of pressure on Chris Paul at the age that he's at, and the Bucks are not making it easy for him. Their length, their size, it's really tough. The one thing that I think that, you know, the Suns miss the most, and I never thought I would say this, Chase, is Dario Saric. He's only played 2 minutes in this series. He's been out, you know, since game one. And the reason why I say that is because if you have a Jrue Holiday hounding Chris Paul all the way up the floor, Dario Saric, you can insert him into the game, and he could be one of those guys that is really going to lay the screen on a Jrue Holiday to prevent him from doing that. You can't risk DeAndre Ayton in those situations, because one foul call, you know, could really leaves you in a bad, bad place. Mm-hmm. But Saric has six fouls. If he gets into foul trouble, it's not a big deal because he's not your go-to guy. But those six fouls are meaningful, and he's also a big body. So he can shove and move around and set screens a little bit more aggressively, knowing that he has those six fouls to give. And I think that they miss that because, you know, you bring Kaminsky off the bench. He's not doing that for you. He is a big body, but he is not a physical presence. And he's definitely a liability defensively, so you can't play him a lot. But Saric is that guy that I think they miss. Not a lot of people are talking about that because he wouldn't have swung the series, but he would definitely be a contributor in the series. And I don't think it would look as bad on the glass if he was in the game.
Interesting. Moving forward. Damian Lillard, Carlin. I don't really know what to make of what his future is in Portland. Nothing would surprise me at this point with Portland, and not for the better, I would say. But it per the Ringer's Kevin O'Connor, he said the Heat, the Kings, the Knicks, and the Sixers have been the most aggressive for Damian Lillard. Of that four, who for you makes the most sense, and why is it Philadelphia?
It's definitely Philadelphia.
Yes. Okay, we're on the same page. I got into a heated back and forth last week on this where I'm like, I don't know, why are we acting like it's not Philadelphia? Philadelphia is the most logical, and it's not even close, and it's also just the best that Portland can get, right? Like, Ben Simmons is better than whatever they can get in any of these other options.
And that's why I think it should be Philadelphia. I think, you know, it just makes too much sense. It would be nice to see him in any of those other cities. I understand that. But when you're looking at what the Portland Trailblazers can get back as an asset, there's not going to be a bigger chip on the table than Ben Simmons. We're talking about a guy, yes, he can't shoot from the foul line, and apparently doesn't want to even shoot jump shots. But he can do so many different things on the basketball court that a lot of players can't do. And I do believe that at some point he's going to figure out a way to at least become what Giannis is, where he's really dominant in and around the rim. He's never going to be a great three-point shooter, but at least he's not going to be fearful of going to the line and taking those foul shots at the end of a game. So that's going to change at some point. Maybe a change of scenery might help with that. going to a place like Portland, where they're largely supportive of their stars. Like, when Portland is not a city where, you know, if you're playing bad, they're going to boo you. They're going to support you no matter what in Portland. Philly's the opposite. Philly might be, other than New York, might be the worst city to play in when you're a little bit skeptical on the basketball floor, because even at, you know, you could play 82 road games if you were in the Philadelphia 76er uniform, because you know if you play poorly on the road, you're going to get booed. And if you know if you play poorly at home, you might even get booed even louder. So getting Ben Simmons out of that environment, I think, helps. I think, you know, there's obviously rumors about the Portland Trailblazers trying to sell the franchise. You know, obviously Damian Lillard, from a definitely from an American perspective, he's a bigger star than Ben Simmons, and he would bring more value to the franchise, you know, potentially in a sale by being on the team. But Ben Simmons has international appeal. Like, he is a massive star internationally, globally, and he's very young, you know, so you can sort of build a brand around Ben Simmons. So you're not losing much there when you bring in a Ben Simmons. You put Ben Simmons on that team, you know, 70% of Australia automatically becomes Portland Trailblazer fans. You kind of get a whole country to support you. And because the Portland Trailblazers play on the West Coast, their games are in more favorable time zones than they would be for Australia when Ben Simmons plays in Philadelphia. You're looking at 9 a.m. versus, you know, around, you know, 10 a.m. noon, depending on when we are in daylight savings time or not, for games in Australia. And you get a lot more support because people can watch, you know, on their lunch break, or people can watch, you know, on their Saturday off in the midday. So I think the Portland Trailblazers definitely make sense for Ben Simmons, and vice versa. I think, you know, Lillard is the piece that the Philadelphia 76ers are definitely missing. And showing my East Coast bias, I would love to have Damian Lillard on the East Coast and watch him at 7 p.m. rather than staying up, rubbing my eyes late at midnight to watch him drop 55 against the Nuggets at 1 a.m. in the morning. I don't want that anymore, Chase. I want him on the East Coast where I can watch him do his work and get to bed at a decent hour. That's all I ask. That's all. Bring all the stars to the East Coast. Forget about the West Coast. That's all I ask.
I was writing about Monday Night Raw at 4:30 a.m. This morning.
Oh, jeez. So. I'm a big Raw fan. You know, I'm a big wrestling fan, Chase.
And yeah.
Not to go off on a tangent, but that was the first time I watched Raw in a while live, like for the whole thing. Normally I'll listen to a podcast or two and I'll go back and pick out things that they tell me to watch. Last night I was a fan again. You know, the Cena open was great. And then they ended it with that, you know, fart in church, I'll call it. All respect to ASH, almost superhero, and it's a great moment for her personally, but I don't think you can end a Raw like that. It doesn't leave the taste in my mouth that I want to come back, especially when on Wednesdays I know I'm going to be entertained for 2 hours. That's my wrestling take for the thing.
Oh, you gotta read my column, Carlin, because I got scorched earth. Like, everything after, like, I laid out, it's kind of amazing. Like, whoever booked this show is like, all right, we're going to do the two good things first. Like, the fact, like, you know, a pro wrestling show has gone off the deep end when the Symphony of Destruction match with Elias and Jackson Baker is the highlight of your show.
Oh,
like, that, that's a problem when that is the number one garnered reaction. And doing, I was so personally offended at them doing Charlotte versus Rhea again, like, less than 24 hours after it happened last night, when that match literally stole the show. Like, that was an absolute banger at Money in the Bank Sunday.
It was.
And you didn't have to.
It was the best match on the card.
Right. Yeah. You let it go. Like, you just pull Rhea for a little bit. You let her hide out, like, after Mox lost to Omega. Like, it's okay to let stuff breathe and to pull them and just sell the injuries because of what Charlotte did to her knee and the way she won. Just pull Ripley for a little bit. That show was atrocious. Like, up and down the line. Like, everything was bad after Cena. Like, Cena started everything off and then was like, all right, now everything's going to just progressively get worse. And Nikki Ash and, like, this whole idea of giving people titles to get them over instead of getting people over and then giving them the title has always plagued this creative team. And Nikki's just not over. Like, fans did not care. And this character is still not developed. Like, she's not over. Like, if you put Liv Morgan in this spot, I think this works. I think last night works. I think this works. Like, fans are ready to cheer for Liv Morgan. And they are. Like, if you watch that show, like, you see it. Like, they were in on Liv Morgan. She's been around a long time. Her character's over. She's got real babyface potential. Nikki Ash or ASH doesn't. Like, she's just not over. It's not fun. It's stupid. It seems like a merch thing. And it's not a shot at Nikki because she's a talented worker, but it's just, that was a terrible way to end Raw. Charlotte versus Becky is what everybody wants. And now you're making this Becky return murky with Bianca on SmackDown. And like, it doesn't make sense for Becky to return there. It doesn't, like, it just, it's right there to build Raw around Becky and Charlotte. And they're just another, and then Keith Lee just not having his music. So fans and like me sitting, I was like, I don't even know who that is coming out. And then it's just right. Keith Lee, like, getting rid, like, you missed a moment because you just didn't, it's like a clerical error. Just, if bask in his glory, if that hits first, we know exactly what's happening and the crowd's losing their minds because they remember that. They don't remember any of this. Like, oh man, see what happens here. I'm going off on this tangent. And then Karrion Kross.
No,
like,
you're right.
Oh my you're goodness. Right. Oh my goodness.
Right. It felt, you know what it felt like, Chase? It felt like a lot of, they were trying to go for a lot of internet memeable moments that just fell flat. Like the Goldberg stuff, we knew about it for a long time. I think you could be a little bit more creative. You know that we know, but you'd be a little bit more creative by the way you roll it out. The Karrion Kross thing, I mean, I'm not a huge NXT fan, but I understand that this guy's been, you know, dominating over there. And you bring him up and you have him lose the way that he lost to Jeff Hardy to do what? To build him as a, you know, as a what? As a loser? That's insane. The first time that I see him on the main stage, that's my impression of him, is that he's a Brooklyn brawler. Like, what are we doing here?
They also just don't explain why he's there. Like, this idea, like, it's just...
Yeah, where'd he come from?
Why is he here? Why? Like, you could easily tell the story, and this is what I wrote about it. I'm like, he's literally in a storyline where him and Regal, like, they had to bring in Samoa Joe to keep the peace. Just say that he was shipped away. That Regal was like, I'm not dealing with this dude anymore. And they moved into Raw. Like, they were like, nobody else, we don't want you here. Go see what happens on Raw. Like, it's an easy story to tell. Instead, it was a vague vignette. And if you're watching NXT, it's insulting where it's like, are they just pretending he doesn't have Scarlett Bordeaux? Like, just acknowledge that.
Where was she? Right.
Oh, my God. It's such a dumb company. It's so dumb. I don't know why I get mad online. And then getting mad online and writing about this at 4 a.m. is wild times, Carlin. It's wild times.
It is. So I'll see you there for Friday. That's what it comes down to.
Hey, Friday. Exactly. You just got to get through the Monday slog. But you know nature is healing when Monday Night Raw is grinding my gears. Kyle Lowry, do you like the fit in New Orleans? Because
I hate it.
I do.
I hate it. For me, Kyle Lowry is, you know, he's the greatest Raptor of all time. And I have a unique perspective from this. I grew up in Canada. He is the best Raptor of all time. I know some people out on the outside looking in will say, well, that's Vince Carter. No, it's not. It's Kyle Lowry. Vince Carter was the guy that sort of brought the spotlight to Canada, brought spotlight to Toronto, and deserves a lot of credit for putting Toronto on the map, essentially. But Kyle Lowry is the guy that raised the franchise to heights that it never would have gotten to. If Kyle Lowry doesn't arrive in Toronto, there's no shot that Kawhi Leonard has the opportunity to come over and win a title. You know, he really set the standard very high and should be the guy that has his jersey retired. So that all being said, he's not going to New Orleans to rebuild. Like, New Orleans isn't ready for a title. If Kyle Lowry's going to leave Toronto, he's going to go to a situation where he's winning one more championship before he calls it quits. And that's not going to happen in New Orleans. There is a lot that New Orleans needs. And a veteran point guard should be at the top of that list, especially if they're going to get rid of Lonzo Ball or allow him to walk. But Kyle Lowry is not the fit there, because Kyle Lowry is not going into a situation on any team where he looks at it and says, hey, I'm going to get Zion to the next level. No, he's not interested in that in this point of his career. He's interested in going to a team where he looks around and says, oh, there are other guys like-minded, like me, that want to get to the finals, not just get to the playoffs. Like, we saw him see Zion in the playoffs. We saw him see New Orleans and Brandon Ingram in the playoffs. He's not interested in getting them to the playoffs. Like, he's not going to do what Chris Paul did last year in trying to get Phoenix over the hump. He's looking to go to a ready-made situation where, whether that's Miami or maybe even Philly, depending on if they keep Ben Simmons or not. You know, I don't see him on the West Coast. I really do see him staying in the East Coast. I really do see him in Miami. You know, it's been rumored for a long time. I think that makes the most sense in the current climate of the NBA. You know, what happened with Victor Oladipo is very unfortunate. I think Miami needs to find a way to replace that gamble. And it would be great to have Kyle Lowry there, because he's the perfect star, Chase, that doesn't need the basketball. And that's so rare in the NBA. He's going to be able to take a charge when you need him to take one. He's going to be able to knock down a big shot when you need him to knock it down. And he's always going to put your team at ease when he has the ball at the point guard position. And I think that's the next step for the Miami Heat. Dragic is a great point guard, but he's a sixth man at this point of his career. So And Tyler Hero, we saw the season he had. We can't expect him to, you know, take that leap that we were expecting him to take. So you just have a lot of calm with Kyle Lowry with the ball in his hands. And I do expect him to make it to Miami if he leaves Toronto. If he doesn't leave Toronto, there's a trade scenario later down the line, I think the NBA is going to have to look drastically different for me to pick a spot for him to end up in. But I just don't think it's New Orleans. If that's a rebuilding situation, this is a guy that wants to win a ring.
I also just think New Orleans is just done. Like, I've moved on from any New Orleans optimism. David Griffin calls me, so I hope he doesn't hear me. But, like, everything is bad there. Like, everything is bad. The juju's bad. Zion's family already getting antsy about things there. Willie Green taking over. We'll see what that looks like. But Brandon Ingram and Zion is never going to be the cleanest of fits. They're just, it's a weird roster, weird pressure there. And then, obviously, Seattle's limping. So I just...
Where's the pressure coming from? That's why I don't understand. Like, Zion has not even played, you know, 100 games in his life, and you're giving him his third coach in 3 years. Like, that's insane. And then obviously, like, New Orleans, no offense, New Orleans, that's a football town. Like, they don't care whether the Pelicans win or not. Like, they've had the luxury of hiding behind Drew Brees for the last two seasons. Now that's gone away. But, you know, the rest of the town is not putting any pressure on Zion to perform. They're going to be looking at Jameis Winston as the savior of the franchise. And they're going to be throwing all their bad juju towards that. Like, Zion and Pelicans could sneak on the radar. They're fine. Like, Griff should not feel any pressure. You know, as long as they make the playoffs this year, they'll be fine. And you don't even have to make the playoffs. Just make the play-in game. You know, like, that's a step forward. Just finally make the play-in game. Zion, we've created this thing for you, and you haven't been in it for the last 2 years. Get there the third year. Get there the third year. That's all.
Yeah, we'll see. I'm going to bet against it. Until proven otherwise, I'm going to bet against it. Also, New Orleans is the sneakiest, smallest TV market in basketball. Like, that is just a universal truth. It's a small market, smaller than Memphis. And if the NBA is not going to expand, which I hope they don't, I just don't think it's going to help the health of the league. So if that's the case, moving them would be great. Back in Seattle. There you go. Zion in Seattle. I would much more prefer that, I would say.
I don't want him on the West Coast, Chase. I'm sorry.
You know what would be amazing? Like, how easy would our lives be, Carlin, if we just all had sports on when sports are on for West Coast people? Like, I tell my girlfriend this all the time, where I'm like, it's amazing. Like, I cannot imagine waking up to football at 11 a.m. and just being done with the Braves at like 6 o'clock. Like, that is incredible.
It was great for me when I was living in Australia. I lived there for 4 years prior to moving. I'm in Charlotte, North Carolina now. And when I was over there, the first East Coast game, I should say, would tip. And normally it was the Wizards. For some odd reason, the Wizards always start like 7 p.m. sharp. Like, they don't wait till 7:01. It's no TNT broadcast. Like, they're starting at 7 p.m. sharp. And that tips off at 9 a.m. Australian time, Sydney time. And the game's done at 11 a.m. So sometimes I wouldn't even eat breakfast before I watched my first NBA game. Like, it was weird to have that sort of calendar flip in your mind and watch, you know, wake up and watch a game at 9 a.m. But it was great because all of my basketball watching would be done maybe by 2, and I would go to the beach afterwards. Like, it was the greatest thing ever invented is just having that clock on at that time, and then I could watch local sports if I wanted to in Australia, you know, at night. So for a sporting fan, Australia has the best time zone for that. If you have an irregular job, if you have a normal job, like if you're working 9 to 5, it absolutely sucks because you'll never be able to see anything. But, you know, if you have an irregular job where you can kind of cheat and pull up League Pass at the work computer or you know, watch during the day periodically, you're fine. It is a great, great situation.
Absolutely. Last thing, we'll wrap up here, Carlin. Your favorite and least favorite coaching hire this cycle. Who is it?
The least favorite, I don't know if I can. I don't know if I have a least favorite because a lot of these coaches are going to be brand new. I mean, you know, I guess I could say Chauncey Billups just because of what he's brought into the Portland Trailblazers, the drama that he's brought, and they may lose Lillard over it. I think, you know, if you're a Portland fan, that's probably your least favorite hire of all time if that comes to fruition. So I'll go with Billups there. But you know, I think my favorite has to be Jamal Mosley in Orlando. And when I look at that Orlando Magic team, it is going to be tough to get me to watch a game. But, you know, you've been hearing about, you know, Jamal for a little while here. And I think that, you know, if everything that we've been hearing about him is correct, he's going to turn that Magic franchise around pretty quickly. And they need it. You know, they haven't been relevant for, I mean, almost, you know, 15 years now. But let me take that back. In the late 2010s, they were a team to be reckoned with. But since Dwight Howard left in 2013, that team, you know, hasn't been great. So I would like to see them relevant again. You know, they obviously are rebuilding. They trade away Vucevic. That made that clear that they're going to be rebuilding. They trade away Aaron Gordon. They're going to be rebuilding. So this draft is going to be huge for them. I do want them, you know, to kind of get some young talent in there. And you know, they have guys that I'm waiting for to take the next step. Mo Bamba, I'm waiting for him to take the next step. And I know big men take a little while to get there, but he now has no more excuses with Vucevic elsewhere. You know, I really want to see a healthy season from some of these guys. Markel Fultz, I would love to see a healthy season from him. You know, I would love to see a healthy season from a Jonathan Isaac. You know, those are the names that I think, you know, the Orlando Magic could build around. They just need health and, you know, just continue to accumulate talent there and they'll be okay.
Mosley's interesting because I think I wrote about this too, of just like Clifford and what he got out of that, and Clifford making a weird gamble to me, being 60 and being on multiple head coaching stops. And just like, I remember reading a piece, I forgot which newspaper it was, but like, I think it may have been the Orlando Sentinel, but like, oh, he's eyeing Boston and Portland. I'm like, he's not getting out of his jobs. Who believes the Celtics are moving on from Stevens for Steve Clifford, or who believes that Neil O'Shea is gonna I was wondering about this because I'm like, obviously there was a disconnect with the Magic and Clifford in that like he wanted to win and they traded Fournier, Gordon, and and Vucevic, and clearly things were changing, but he also got them to back-to-back playoff seasons when it was like they have been irrelevant and just bad. And like the Rob Hennigan era is not that long ago. And just the end of the Otis Smith era, like it was really, really bad for a long time. And you just saw Frank Vogel move on and just won a title with the Lakers. And he struggled in Orlando, and Jock Vaughn struggled in Orlando. And Borrego is obviously doing well in Charlotte. And then you look at Clifford, who got a lot out of nothing. DJ Augustine was a starting point guard in that Raptors game you were talking about. He hit the game winner. Like, he put the Raptors on notice early. I would bet against Mosley. Like, I would bet against him being better than, like, if you look at this roster and just how young it is, they have no 30-year-olds on this team. Like, young teams don't win the NBA, and they have two lottery picks that he's going to be asked to also develop along with Jamal Okiki. You got Mo Bamba, as you cited, Markel Fultz, like Terrence Ross is your lead vet. But you look at this group and it's just youth everywhere. Jonathan Isaac coming back, hopefully healthy, but like, there's no scoring. There's all kinds of questions there. And we just see this time and time again, this kind of youth, like he's getting fired in 2 years. Like, this team's going to be awful for the next 2 years. And it's just, it's unbelievably hard for these coaches to survive like a 3-year bad stretch. Like, Lloyd Pierce went through it. Brett Brown obviously went through it. I'm worried about Steven Silas and what he's dealing with for the next couple of years in Houston. Like, it's just, the teams are not patient, and they say they are in the hiring process. Like, we're going to rebuild, we're going to do this right. But then when you go 65 and 180, it just wears, and it's just really, really hard to survive. And it doesn't matter how good of an in-game tactician Mosley is, it's just an unwinnable situation in the short term, I think, for him.
Yeah, but the one thing that he kind of gets a pass on is that, you know, there's a GM in there, Jeff Waltman, that has been there, who's made these decisions for, you know, he's had time to kind of turn this thing around in Orlando. And this is kind of his last shot, really. You know, he's not going to get another rebuild. You know, this is it for him. So when you look at that, you know, he took over from the Hennigan era. When you look at that, you know, if they come out the gate slow, especially if they have another season where, you know, there are 20, 25 wins, no one's going to be pointing this finger at Jamal Mosley. They're going to all be pointing it at Waltman, saying he's not getting enough talent there for this wonder kid of a head coach to, you know, to really perform with. So I think Jamal will get his leash will be a lot longer than, you know, it would have been if he came in with the GM you know, hand in hand. This is going to be really Jeff Waltman's last shot, and he can't miss. So, you know, he's going to give Jamal everything that he needs to really produce. They have two top 10 picks, I believe, right in this draft
coming
up.
Yeah.
Yeah, 5 and 8. So that should help. They, you know, Jeff can't blow it. You know, he got the wizard coach that everybody really wanted him to get. He had two top, you know, 5 picks to accelerate this rebuild. And then you have a little bit of change that you can spend and hopefully entice that mid-tier, you know, bet that, you know, doesn't want to pay taxes and he just wants to come down to Florida and golf a lot, you know, intrigue him to come play in Orlando and say, hey, you're going to get a lot of touches. Maybe we'll showcase you for a championship team down the line. But while
it's never happened. Look at their, like, it's Trace McGrady, end of list. Like, that is it. Yeah. That is the Orlando Magic history. It's Trace McGrady, end of list.
They got Grant Hill. It just didn't work out for Grant. Like, think about how different their history would be had Grant Hill not gotten hurt. You know, think how different that history would be if Dwight Howard and Stan Van Gundy don't start butting heads. Like, yes, Dwight Howard falls off a cliff, you know, later on in life, but he still was a valuable member, to a championship team, and he still was a face of a franchise. Orlando hasn't had a face since he's left, and they're still searching for that. And maybe they can pick that up in this draft. I don't know if it's Scotty Barnes. He's a decent player, but they need someone to kind of be the face of Orlando basketball. And every time you think about Orlando basketball, if you're still thinking about Shaq and Penny and Dwight Howard, like, and Tracy McGrady, like, these are guys that, you know, three out of four of those guys are retired. Like, that shouldn't happen. When you're thinking about a franchise, and you can immediately think about the player that defines that franchise that is currently playing, well, guess what? Your franchise is in a bad, bad way. And that's going to be Houston. That's going to be Orlando, which we talked about. That could be Portland if they trade Dame Lillard. So that's where it sits with me. Sacramento Kings have at least De'Aaron Fox. So, you know, it all is not grim for them. But when you're looking at, you think about your team, you say, hey, who is the guy that defines their franchise? What's the face of it? If you don't have one, then you end up being the Detroit Pistons and the Rockets and then the Cleveland Cavaliers. So the Orlando Magic are in that tier. They have two shots in this top 10 here in a week or so to figure it out. So hopefully they're able to do it.
I hope so. But the cynic in me would hedge against it, Carl. What can we check out from you across NBA International this week?
Yeah, we got a lot going on. It really all depends on, you know, the game six. I think if the Bucks win game six, we're going to give them the credit where it's due, especially Giannis. It'll be incredible to really kind of celebrate him. And as an international player, it is the first time that we're going to have a guy that's not born in the U.S. that is the face of the league. I don't think anyone can take that away from him. It's well deserved. Like, since Dirk, and even I would even say, even including Dirk, because when Dirk won the championship, no one was arguing that he was the best player in the league. The best player in the league was still on the opposite team. It was still LeBron James. It was like, hey, why didn't LeBron get there? This, if Giannis is able to do this, he is pound for pound the best player in the league. And you can make arguments against him, but it's going to be on deaf ears. So that's a huge, huge moment, I think, for the game globally. And it would be a perfect time because you're leading into the Olympics where we've seen Team USA go and kind of look shaky. They're not sitting in their best unit there. And this is a team that's very vulnerable, that's going up against a lot of, very talented teams from around the world that have been together for quite some time. My sleeper pick, Chase, this is for all the bettors out there. I'm not a betting man, but, if I was, I would say that the Czech Republic are going to bring home a medal.
Okay.
They haven't been to the Olympic Games since the separation of Czechoslovakia. This is their first time as the Czech Republic that they go to the Olympic Games. They finished sixth place at the FIBA World Cup. They shocked a lot of teams by getting there. I was in Canada. I called the Olympic qualifiers where they beat Canada in overtime. They go on to beat Greece, and they're now in the Olympic Games. They're in the same group as Team USA. They're going to play Team USA very close in that game, and it's going to shock a lot of people that the Czech Republic are very close to Team USA in that game. They may even pull off the upset, but I do feel that the Czech Republic are going to pull home a medal. It's not going to be gold. If they do get a medal, it's going to be bronze. But I have my money on them to come home with a bronze medal. So you can look out for that stuff all on NBA.com International. We'll be watching the Olympics heavily. And of course, the draft, we touched on it a little bit. Speaking of international players, you have Alperen Şengün, who I had opportunity to watch up close and personal. Really, really, really like him. He's 18. He's very physical, back to the basket, old school big. Can't shoot threes, so that's why he's not getting the hype that you would get from, you know, those international prospects that, you know, come out of Europe. But this guy is a stud. He, you know, 18 and 10 in his pro league, and as an 18-year-old, Chase, that's pretty good. When you have other men that understand that you're going to the next level and they're trying to make a name off of you by having their best game of their lives against you, and you still average 18 and 9 as an 18-year-old, that's pretty good. You know, you're a good player. I don't care what level you're playing at. So he's a solid, solid player out of Turkey. You know, Usman Garuba, he's actually from Spain. He's on the national team. Some people would have saw him in that exhibition game against Team USA. I think he's solid, too. There's a lot of international players. Josh Giddey from Australia, very, 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 very level-headed point guard. He's getting taller and bigger by the minute, it seems like. I think he would be a good fit, actually, in New Orleans. We were talking about guards to go to New Orleans. He would be a perfect point guard to go there. So there is a lot of international flavor over the next couple of weeks that we can look forward to. It starts with Giannis, you know, if he's able to, you know, close it out here, leading into the Olympics, and, of course, the NBA draft. So check out NBA.com International. We'll have a cover for you.
All right. Well, go do that, folks. Carlin, thank you so much for making the time. It was good to check back in. Let's do it more often, man. This is great.
Yeah, definitely. Next time I'm back, I'm in Knoxville, I'll definitely give you a call. We got to go see, either watch your balls or figure out a way to get down to Central and watch the Central Bobcats do their thing.
Absolutely, absolutely. I'll be rocking the Oak Ridge stuff. The girlfriend is actually an Oak Ridge alum, so I gotta be careful with my allegiances here.
The rivalry game there.
Exactly, exactly. Carlin, thank you so much. I'll talk to you soon.
Appreciate you, man.
Nicely done, nephew. Chase Thomas Podcast. Hell yeah.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market. Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.